Happy Sabbath evening, everybody. Our study this seventh day of November is entitled Earth's Bindery. A bindery, according to Webster, is a place where books are bound. Books are merely organized collections of written pages containing specialized and pertinent information that is often useful for instruction. Pages of information must be bound together by a binder and a writer to enlighten and to convey a harmonious, restorative, and unimpeachable message. For salvation, humanity needs such a journal so as to reunite with God. The Bible is comprised of many books. God has graced us with a binder of restitution. Let us begin to examine this perspective by turning to Matthew chapter 16. We're going to read verses 13 through 19. And there we will see our salvation. And when I say our salvation, the victory of the church over the devil, our ability to walk in righteousness, our ability to obtain eternal peace and joy, requires the deployment of the Lord of an effective bindery. When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea of Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets." He said unto them, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said unto him, "Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind," shall what? "Whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." The Lord began his study, prepared to deliver to you disciples today the message that we just read. And he began by inquiring to hopefully inquisitive minds. It turned out that nobody in the church had bothered to give much thought to the identity of the Lord, as evidenced by the fact that some thought that he was John the Baptist. How thoughtful could they have been, V.T. Hata points out, when John the Baptist baptized the Lord? People operate at different levels of intellectual acuity. And we don't make small of that. This is why the Lord has teachers. You bring a lot of people together in a group and you ask them a question, and then you find out that they don't know, and so you begin to break it down. Some thought that he was Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. It didn't seem like the Lord was disappointed, because he directed his inquiry to the disciples. "What about you? How much thought have you given to it?" And to our shock, I say our shock, if you've given it a lot of thought, you'll be shocked, Simon Peter piped out with the correct answer. But Simon Peter could not become joyous, too much so, over his thoughtfulness, his ministerial acuity, his wisdom. Because the Lord didn't give him credit. He said, this revelation that you have brought to us did not come from your own engeneration, flesh and blood. The Father which is in heaven revealed it unto you. That speaks a mouthful. That's a sermon in itself. I wish we could linger a lot longer on that point of emphasis, but suffice it to say that the Father did not unlock the minds of the elitists in the church, did not unlock the minds of the meekest in the church. For some reason or another, the Father said, there's my man. I'm going to unlock his mind. Which shows to you that he hid it from everybody else. There was no intellectual power on planet Earth that could answer that question. So don't be shocked or surprised when you find out that you're learning truth today that has never been understood before, and that the ministries of the world and the ministries of the Christian church, the ministries of the Davidia and Seventh-day Adventism don't understand. They've all got the same, to use a colloquial expression, goofball answers that the Lord received. Who was Peter? Peter was one of the disciples. But now we know a little bit about his credentials. He was favored of the highest. Favored of Father. Oh, I don't believe the parents should show favor. God does. Peter was given the keys. The keys to the kingdom. What does that really mean? We know that it wasn't a literal key, like the key to your car or the key to your house. Its usefulness symbolically delivers to us an important message. We spend a lot of time in study to show that the kingdom belongs to Christ. There will be no kingdom without his initiation of it. Therefore, Peter was given the keys to Christ. Why was he given the keys to Christ? Because Father, through Peter, showed the disciples that Christ was not God, was not Elijah, was not a prophet, but he was the Son of God. That was a novel finding. It had to be recognized as novel because nobody else came up with it. People were looking for the Son of David. People were looking for prophets to emerge. But nobody went around looking for the Son of God. But why, again, I mean, there's several reasons. Let us explore this idea to a deeper depth. Why is Peter given the keys to Christ? Understand what a key does. A key opens the door. Without the key, you cannot legally gain entry if the door is locked. Therefore, we know that the door is shut and locked because it needs a key. The mastery of discerning Christ and his name and his identity is a theme that was locked to his church. Why do you suppose the Lord locked it away to his church? What could be the reason that would compel the Father to commission Christ to hide the truth about his kingdom? I say the truth about his kingdom. We're just learning about his kingdom. We know now that it begins as a mustard seed. We know that it doesn't begin with a collection of people landing themselves in Palestine. We know that it begins in the wilderness. of the people in the United States. We know that it's going to be ruled by an eternal king who is going to descend from the son of David. We know that it's going to be instrumental to evangelize the world. We know that people who join the kingdom are going to have life everlasting. We know that at least the leaders that are contained therein are going to have joy forevermore. All these things we know because Peter unlocked the door. We didn't know these things before. Why was it locked? I think I'm going to pause here and see if somebody can give me an answer to that. Let's not make that a rhetorical question. The reason why Christ locked the door is the same reason why you lock your door. Because the neighborhood is full of thieves. That's why. If people understood the intricacies of the kingdom, they would use that for self-glorification. Look what happened with Moses when he distributed the Spirit to the 70 elders. When it came time to back Moses up, they all turned against him. People are seeking their own glory because they're lacking in meekness. They're thieves. This is what we learn as we read in John chapter 10, sidestepping our text of Matthew 16 for a minute. Then said Jesus unto them, again, verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. Verse 8, all that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The Lord had to lock the door because there were so many thieves. What do thieves steal? They steal the same thing they try to steal today. See, the reason why people steal money is because they want power. That's why. Instead of cutting their grass themselves, they want to be able to pay somebody to cut it. Instead of cooking their meals themselves, they want to go to fancy restaurants. Instead of working hard to buy a car, they want to look good in a new car and a new suit by having somebody else's money. This is the same thing that the world has been inundated with. Until the emergence of Peter. You've got it by now. We've just understood it before. Peter is an icon of the Son of David. Now, let us begin to realize that false shepherds do not teach unpopular truths. And when you refuse to teach unpopular truths, we've spoken to this a little bit earlier, then what you're doing is you're preserving your reputation from ridicule. Imagine, brethren in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, I never thought you'd hear this, are denying when they converse with me that some of us are not going to go into the grave. They're saying everybody's got to die. The reason why they're saying that is because they're thieves. They do not want somebody else to receive Bible credit. So rather than acknowledge through meekness that they or something in the Bible they didn't understand, they deny it. Thieves. They want to protect their reputation, and to protect their reputation, they make Christ out to be a fool. He said the hour is coming when all that sleep are going to be resurrected. It says that you can look for the more precise wording in John chapter 5. But if that day is going to come when there's going to be this resurrection, then the man of meekness, who's the honest teacher, the one who deserved the keys to Christ, the antitypical, the son of David, ought to be able to announce beforehand, hey, that day that Christ promised, it's around the corner. The Lord said, surely the Lord God will do nothing but that he revealeth the secrets to his servants, the prophets. You might as well be told what's going to happen tomorrow. And if you don't believe it, then it's a statement about your faith. And see, that's the problem with our connection to the Lord and to heaven. We think that God is very careful about who he sends to speak for him. We think that he is very restrictive. Oh no, that person's garments are stained, they can't talk for me. That person is disreputable, they can't deliver my message. Why, he took Balaam's ass and talked through him. The reason why he doesn't talk through people is because he's got things to tell you that are going to shock you. And you're not going to be bold enough to deliver that message. Oh, the 144,000 are going to emerge from the sons of America's former slaves. How many people do you think wanted to hear that? Oh, why did I open up and tell the world that Christ was different than Jesus? Seems like an easy thing to tell people, but it's not. You print that up and you distribute it and you sweat in anticipation of the reaction until you become immune to the reaction. I'm telling you from the heart. I'm telling you what we've experienced. Then somebody says, wow, that's good. I never understood it that way. And that makes up for all the insults that you receive. The Lord said, verse 8 of John 10, I'm reading again, all that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. Why do you suppose that the sheep did not hear them? The sheep did not hear them because you are the sheep. The message could not be proclaimed until the Lord gave to Peter the key. And he unlocked the door and delivered the message. Which means that the sheep heard other things. This is what we're studying. We're studying our journey, our tabernacle journey through the wilderness. There are a lot of valuable teachings that we learned yesterday when the ordained ministry of the Lord staked out his tabernacle. And today, because the same ministry now, ordained by the Lord, I say, is the same, upstaked the tabernacle and moved it. But the sheep are the ones that are going to hear the Lord's voice. We are going to be converted to shepherds, and then we are going to declare to Israel this gospel truth. And those sheep are going to hear the Lord's voice, which goes to show you that the Lord controls the bindery of the gospel. And that's why he says the gates of hell are not going to prevail against it. What are the gates of hell? Gates of hell is that broad way which everybody wants to follow. Seeks to swallow up the world. And it looks like it has done so. But the gates of hell are going to be frustrated. They're going to be stopped. They cannot gain victory over the Lord's disciples indeed. I like the point that was made earlier. Maybe we should spend a little bit more time unraveling its meaning. As we turn to Psalms chapter 91, it's important to understand that Father purposefully hid these things. And when Father hides something, you're not going to be able to unfurl it. It's locked away. Verse 1 of Psalms 91. Then I'm going to read verses 8 through 10 and verses 14 through 16. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Oh, this person, therefore, has to be a reference to the one whom Peter prefigured, the one whom the Lord would use to open up the revelations of himself, open up the door. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High. That means that Father has a place that's hidden. And understand the use of that term, place. That's important. We'll make greater mention of it as we advance. But there's somebody that dwells in the secret place. That means the rest of the world does not recognize the significance of his dwelling house, his place. He dwells in the secret place of the Most High. He abides under the shadow of the Almighty. The Lord has them hidden until it's time to reveal His identity. Verse 8. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked, because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. I'm reading verse 14. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. With long life, verse 16, will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. The Lord promises to show him salvation. The Lord promises to set him on high. Consequently, you're not going to find him on high until the Lord sets him on high. You're not going to understand the Lord's salvation. You're not going to understand Christ until the Lord unfolds it to this individual. Let me just garner the major theme of Psalms 91, the point of great emphasis. And that point is that this place is a theological designation. It's not a physical designation. What I mean by that is that this individual that is guaranteed the keys, we know that he's guaranteed the keys. We know that he has to be prefigurative of antitypical Peter, because he says in the last verse of that chapter, with long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. Nobody else can unlock the concepts of salvation. All those tapes that you've been studying before you met with the mustard seed, all those sermons that you've listened to, all those scriptures that you thought you mastered, throw them all away. You don't understand the Lord's salvation. And there's no benefit of any Bible study unless you can garner salvation of the Lord. But this concept of salvation is what we call a theology. It's a teaching about God. It's a teaching about how you win approval, how you win everlasting life. To learn His salvation, you have to come to a proverbial place. Now, when you think about it, that's not much more different than going to a literal place. You go to a literal place, you say, I don't want to be here, I want to be over there. Or I have to be over there. But some folks travel long and far distances to go to work. You look at the clock and say, I need to be in Washington, D.C. So you make your move to get there. That's the same thing, the same machinations mentally and intellectually that you have to go through to embrace the salvation of the Lord. That's why David poetically defines it as a place. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. In other words, he learns Father's secrets. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. All these years we've been frustrated because it seems like the wicked are winning, because we haven't really seen their reward. But this servant who has had the protection of the Father and who has been enlightened by Him, he's going to see the reward of the wicked. Why? Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. Well, that's a beautiful and wonderful promise, isn't it? Nobody wants to be afflicted with plagues. Everybody wants to be protected from evil. We all like to believe that the angels have charge over us. Well, we get that charge, those marching orders of protection by the angelic angels, when we begin to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. A similar promise was made to David by the prophet Nathan. And Prophet Nathan said, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more. The Lord telleth thee that he will make thee a house." That's 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 10 and 11. As we approach that text from our current perspective, we see that it is likewise a dwelling place. When it says the Lord will appoint a place for his people, they first have to receive the intellectual gospel. They have to be taught righteousness. And before they can be taught righteousness, they have to find somebody that understands salvation. Somebody that has the key. Because you do understand that this is speaking of the day when the children of wickedness are going to cease their afflictions. This does not happen when the children of Israel are garnered together in Palestine. This happens in the wilderness. Palestine is the literal place. The growth and the advancement of the mustard seed is the theological place. But membership in the theological place gives to you the protection from evil. That's why it says the gates of hell shall not prevail against you. The children of wickedness are not going to afflict the children of Israel anymore. The day is going to come when the Lord is going to lift his servant on high. And we're studying about these things now so that we can anticipate that day. It says, "Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him." Now we know that David is speaking of Christ. Because this servant, the one who dwells in the secret place of the Most High, has set his love upon the Lord, upon Christ. Heretofore, we could not understand exactly the full impact of that meaning, of that message. But now we know what it means to love Christ, don't we? Where can I turn to find out what it means to love Christ? John 14, verse 21. "He that hath my commandments and keepeth them, he it is that loveth me. And he that loveth me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him." Verse 23, "If a man love me, he will keep my words." It's not just the commandments, it's his entire message, his words. "If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him. And we will come unto him and make our abode with him." Now do you understand how David's message is in harmony with Christ's message? Both the Father and the Lord make their abiding presence with this person that loves the Lord. He is the one that's given the key. "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." Same as what we just read in John chapter 14. I'm not sure if we're through with Psalms chapter 91. The Lord promised, "I will set him on high," in verse 14. It says, "Therefore will I deliver him, I will set him on high, because he hath known my name." Has to be the one that Nathan promised to ancient David, would the Lord would build a house, because he said that son would build a house for the Lord's name. And the emergence of that son and it comes to being. It says, "He shall," in verse 15, "call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him." That means that he's going to have trouble, but the Lord is going to be with him. He has that assurance. "With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation." The last point that we need to glean from Psalms 91, therefore, is that this is a permanent fixture. Because once you're saved, don't you have it made? Isn't that the purpose of our Christian walk? Isn't that the reason for our wilderness journey? We wanted to be saved. The son of David, recognized now as iconic Peter, the son of David, as a result, establishes an immovable and enduring house. The theology that he teaches is not to be convoluted, and it's not to be contradicted. It will last and endure throughout eternity because it wins for you salvation. We need to understand it that way, because as we revert back to the original theme of this entire series that describes our tabernacle journey, we find in Numbers chapter 1, it says, verse 50 and 51, "But thou shalt appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony, and over all the vessels thereof, and over all things that belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle and all the vessels thereof. They shall minister unto it, and shall encamp round about the tabernacle." Not everybody could receive this assignment, only the Levites has been our point of emphasis. And today, we look even more deeply into that promise from verse 51, where it says, "And when the tabernacle setteth forward, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall pitch it. And the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death." The stranger that cometh nigh. Anybody that is not of the ordained ministry who seeks to handle the oracles of God during this wilderness journey is prescribed death. Death is a very serious episode in everybody's life. It's something that we all fear, isn't it? But now, thankfully, because we know the Lord's salvation, we know that a pronouncement of death doesn't mean an eternal abandonment and a loss of salvation. Because dead people can be resurrected. As a result, we don't have to be disparaged over this text anymore. You see, the peace that the gospel brings to you, the salvation the Lord brings to you, when the church left Jerusalem, they went on a wilderness journey, and they all received death. Thank God that we can now know that the salvation of the Lord by virtue of the judgment of the dead, because in the judgment of the dead, some people are brought forward and given life again. Therefore, their death is a matter of rejoicing, because everybody on the planet since Adam has died. But not everybody since Adam has won everlasting life. Therefore, we could rejoice now what we learned in Psalms 91, because the Son of David, the one who loves the Lord, by virtue of the definition that we read in John 14, is the one that defines what for us? Do you forget? "With long life will I satisfy him," Psalms 91:16, "and show him my salvation." As daunting and as intimidating as the pronouncement of death is, it doesn't mean that this person that receives that curse cannot have salvation. Salvation comes through atonement. There's a judgment that is conducted for all that have died. Now, should we be sad because it doesn't include you? No. Because there's a judgment that's going to be even more mightier that's established for all that are alive. There are a collection of saints that are going to live forever without seeing death. And there are a collection of saints that could not make it. Why could they not make it? Because this gospel was hidden from them. Why was it hidden from them? Because the church was dominated by thieves. The Lord did it to protect us. But I find it remarkable. Before I make any more comment, though, let me refer you to Exodus. And I'll show you what I find remarkable. There's a second shoe to drop from Numbers 1 that fascinates me. And it's really the basis for this study. It's one of the points that we need to underscore. Exodus chapter 25, verse 8. "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." You missed that already. See, I don't see any smiles, any celebration, any jubilation. It says, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I showed thee after the pattern of the tabernacle. That same tabernacle which nobody could touch but the ministry, the Levites. According to all that I showed thee after the pattern of the tabernacle, and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it. What I find remarkable, the first thing that we saw now, is that those people who violate the definition of the tabernacle are pronounced with death. In 1844, when the spirit of prophecy began to work with the church, and the Lord, through his ordained ministry, began to establish doctrines, vegetarianism, dress reform, Saturday Sabbath worship, you know, all of the doctrines, all of the teachings. Viti Hatef came along, you know, and he even established more principles and standards. The Lord was with them. And this is what I find remarkable, because it was his pitched tabernacle in the wilderness. Why is that so remarkable? Because today we don't embrace those doctrines. The tabernacle has been upstate. But yesterday it was a matter of life and death. If you violated those principles, you died. And the reason why I find that so remarkable is because of the other shoe that I promised was going to fall. And that is that Christ dwelt in a transitory tabernacle. Transitory. That's a word you use to describe vagabonds, you see. Homeless people. They go from one shelter to the other. That's what Christ did. He said, make me a tabernacle that I may dwell. When the Gentile church went through the wilderness experience, the Lord perceived that he would dwell with them, not personally, but through the abiding presence of the Spirit. And that ordained ministry set the standards of life and death. Even though those standards were not fixed, permanent, even though they were temporary, is a good word, they were still ordained by the Lord. When the Lord promised to David that he would appoint a place for his people and will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more, he's not talking about a Levitical house. He's talking about another ministry of installation. He's talking about a permanent house. And that's the permanent house that somebody has to be given the key for entry. Suffice it to say, as we examine the two texts, Numbers 1, 50 and 51, and Exodus 25, verses 8 and 9, that Christ accepted an inferior communion. The reason why your parents sent you to school and sent you to kindergarten was not because they wanted you to be an eternal expert in kindergarten education. They wanted you to grow in advance. But they supported you and celebrated your advancements as you went and you proceeded from kindergarten all the way to graduation day when you were 18, 17 years old. That's the same principle that the church was established on. But we're talking about earth's boundary now. We're talking about the day when the gospel is taken from the scriptures and stitched together to make a consistent theme so that we have a permanent edifice theologically, so that we have a permanent doctrine to adhere to and to learn. This is our higher education, and this we acquire by who else but the ready writer. A writer was to establish the doctrine, and a writer was to bind it. Before we read about the ready writer, let us turn to Isaiah chapter 7. There's an important message now that we have to garner from Isaiah. Let's read Isaiah chapter 7, verses 13 through 15. And he said, this is the prophet Isaiah, "Hear ye now, O house of David. It is a small thing for you to weary men, but will ye weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." Oh, I know who Emmanuel is. That represents Jesus. Well, that was the representation that we taught and heralded from yesterday's tabernacle. Today, we are building the permanent edifice. We are unfurrowing the secret places of the Lord. And now we understand that Emmanuel is prefigurative of this icon whom we refer to as the Son of David, and whom the Lord also referred to as Peter, the one who's given the keys of the kingdom. This we know, as we're seeing, because this Emmanuel, what does he do? He does something special, doesn't he? Let's read on. "Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good." Before we read on, though, perhaps we should make a special point of emphasis and uncover the fact that Emmanuel represents a sign to the house of David. Therefore, everybody that receives the sign has descended from the house of David. There's no coincidence why you're sitting here in study, why you're learning the salvation of the Lord, why you are receiving the keys to the kingdom, because you've descended from the house of David. Well, I'm a female. What does it say whether, I mean, David had females in his house as well. This is why it had to be hidden, in fact. You remember the Lord said, I believe it was Matthew chapter 11, "Oh, I thank thee, Father, for hiding these things from the wise and prudent and revealing them unto the babes," because the sign about Emmanuel pertained to the house of David. Or else he would have said it differently. He would have said, "Hear ye now, O Israel, or he that hath an ear, let him hear." But instead of that, he says, "Hear ye now, O house of David." Well, how could I be of the house of David? The house of David came 10 generations after Jacob. And Jacob had Judah. And Judah had Perez. And each step along the way, I could list them all to you. I'm not going to show off today. They all had children that branched off horizontally. The sign was not to them. In fact, Jesse had 8 sons. Eliab was one. He had other sons. I'm not going to list them to you either. None of the descendants of those sons pertain to this. They're Jews. They're from the house of Jesse. They're from the land of Judah. But they're not of the house of David. And then David had Solomon and pointed him to the throne. We saw by our careful examination of genealogy from Luke, we saw that the kingdom was taken out of Solomon's hands. And it was put into Nathan's hands. Therefore, if you can trace your lineage back to ancient Nathan, you qualify as being part of the house of David. You don't have to be my first cousin. I think that's an important point to understand, because we are beginning to uncover the people that have embraced the truth of this gospel, and the people likewise that are hidden in the secret place of the Most High, that abide under the shadow of the Almighty. It's good to know your place in Bible history. Not everybody has that benefit. Not everybody can be given that peace. Let me take you quickly before we're not going to leave Isaiah 7 yet. We have more reading to go there, but we're talking about earth's boundary. We're talking about the disciples. The Lord says, "Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth." That's John 17, verse 17. Some of the saints that are going to emerge in the last day are going to be sanctified with the truth. Remember what David said in Psalms 45 about the king that's to come? He said he's going to reign prosperously in meekness, in truth, and in righteousness. The day is going to come, it is now here, that we are being sanctified through the truth. Neither pray I for these alone, verse 20, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. I want you to see a special point I don't think we've made before from this text. You perhaps will see it as we read verse 21. If not, we'll try to get it from verse 22. That they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. That's the gospel that Peter was ordained to teach. But the Lord said that I am not asking this. If you read chapter 17 carefully, you'll see. I'm not asking this for the original 11 disciples. I'm asking this for those that are going to believe on me through their testimony. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. It's clear, isn't it, that he wanted us to believe that the Father sent the Son. That's the gospel that Peter enunciated. He said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. This is what Christ prayed that you would believe. This is the gospel that Emmanuel, the butter and honey that he was promised to deliver to you. That they all may be one. As thou, the Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us. That the world may believe that thou hast sent me. You see, you're not going to be successful in your ministry. Somebody says, well, what's taking so long? You're not going to be successful in your ministry until you become one. Now, how can you become one? The only way you can become one is if you pass through earth's boundary. That's where you're bound together by the truth. That's why you're sanctified through the truth, so that you understand the gospel and you dwell in the habitation of the Lord that he's established. The theological encampment, the eternal house. The tabernacle has now been upstaked. And now we're building the house. We're destined to become one. And this is why I refer you to Isaiah chapter 7. Verse 15, butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. Well, to be one in Christ, this is what you need to learn, right? Let's read verse 16. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. This is the commission of Isaiah Emmanuel. After he emerges, describes him going in into the prophets and producing the ensign, then it continues to tell you what his assignment is. His assignment is to bind up the testimony and seal the law. The testimony represents what we read and referred to in John chapter 14, represents the testimony that Christ delivered. The words, he that hath my words and keepeth them, he it is that loveth me. Well, the person that loves the Lord, as we saw in Psalms 91, is the person that's going to teach his salvation. And to teach his salvation, something very important has to happen. Something important has to happen to make that transition from that halfway house, the tabernacle, to the eternal house. That inferior communion to the perfect union, the oneness. You have to bind up the testimony and seal the law. Don't worry about sealing it among everybody else. Oh, I've got to go to church and tell them. No, don't worry. Oh, I got to go to my family. Don't tell them. No, don't worry about it. Seal it in your heart. Seal it among the disciples. What is the testimony? The testimony of Jesus. What is the law? It's the law declared by Moses. Those two things. Oh, I hope that you appreciate the full impact of that statement. Verse 17. And I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Shows you the steps of leadership. You want to reveal this gospel to the house of Jacob. They are the sheep that the Lord wants you to lead in and out. You step out of the sheepfold. You bring the sheep back into the sheepfold so that they're part of the Seventh-day Adventist church. In other words, they're part of the three angels' message. Don't worry about the other folks. They're not going to get intermingled. This is a spiritual habitation. They finally receive the gospel as declared since 1844, the three angels' message. And then, that's the day that Emmanuel waits for. He says, I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob. I will look for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel, or from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Let's shorten the study by traveling to verse 20. Verse 20 of Isaiah 8. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. You see the transition that we've made. This is the day where you've come to. This is the day when the tabernacle that you abode with yesterday has no more efficacy. Anything that the saints need to know has been bound up by earth's bindery in the eternal house. It's the formula for salvation. Yesterday, if you violated those principles, then the penalty of violation was death. You would have to receive salvation either by passage through the grave, or you'd have to come into compliance and then graduate in advance to the eternal house, which means that you have to circumcise your heart. We've discussed that through many dimensions in our studies of time past. It means you had to divest yourself of your doctrines of yesterday, and you had to receive the present truth gospel. Now let us examine this binding process from a different perspective. What I want you to see now is that the binding process heretofore has been focused on that which takes place on earth. But that wasn't the totality of iconic Peter's commission, was it? Remember, he was told in Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, I will give thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. It says the binding represents doctrine. It's the testimony and the law. Then there are a portion of saints that are habitating with Christ that are waiting for this message so that they too can understand. Believe it or not, they've been waiting there as long as they've been up there to learn this gospel truth. And do not place limits on the reach of this gospel now, because there are people in heaven that are studying it. Perhaps they're visiting the website. But however they're garnering their information in, they're receiving it by iconic Peter's mission to bind on earth and bind in heaven. You remember the story about Jacob, right? Jacob was shown the ladder that extended from Bethel up to the throne of the Lord. That's the Lord's habitation. Let us turn to Psalms 89, verse 1 through 6. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. That has special meaning in this study, because David says that the teachings that he articulates by this ready writer he expresses in Psalms 45, whom he refers to as the king, he says, I will make known thy faithfulness to all generations. Therefore, all the generations that are in existence around the Lord's throne are studying about his faithfulness. And they're going to be made aware of his faithfulness through somebody who knows how to bind the gospel, presenting the truth from those things that David wrote about in his work. For I have said, mercy shall be built up forever. Thy faithfulness shalt thou establish in the very heavens. In other words, there's faithfulness to Christ that is not established yet. but through David's articulations as unfolded and explained by the ready writer, the iconic Peter, the one who binds up the law and the testimony, it says, the Lord's mercy shall be built up forever. His faithfulness shall thou establish in the very heavens. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn unto David my servant. Thy seed will I establish forever and build up thy throne to all generations. There's that expression again. Now come on. What does it mean, all generations? How are you going to build up this throne to all generations? Last 100 years, how many generations have been here? Well, think about that. That's a perplexion. Think about the last 1,000 years. And then, instead of integrating that vertically, integrate that horizontally. There's generations in the United States. There's generations in other parts of the globe. David says, thy seed will I establish forever and build up thy throne to all generations. The Lord has a mighty task, mighty duty and responsibility. But we shouldn't be surprised with that. Because we on planet Earth, sometimes you can visit an area, and you come back 5 years later, and you see magnificent developments. There's work that's going on at Christ's behest. Remember, he's building David a house as well. There's work going on that you're not aware of. And you needn't be aware of. You could barely manage your own affairs. Let Christ manage his. But he gave a semblance of this to King Asa. King Asa committed an offense that made the Lord upset. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 8, he says, were not the Ethiopians and the Lubans a huge host with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet, because thou didst rely on the Lord, he delivered them into thy hand. In other words, they're in battle. See if you can get the picture. And they outnumbered Israel. But miraculously, the Lord gave them victory. Look at the victory that he promised to give from another perspective. It says, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro through the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him. Therefore, there are people on other parts of the globe. They don't understand religion and theology. They are not even dwelling in the tabernacle church. But the Lord has deemed that these people are strong saints. And if he was making himself strong 3,000 years ago under King Asa's administration, then we can understand what David meant when he said that he, the Lord, would build up David's son's throne to all generations. And the heavens shall praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness also in the congregation of the saints. These people are a congregation that dwells in heaven. They are going to be made appreciative of the faithfulness of the Lord through the bindery work that's going to take place in heaven. That's why he vested in this person that represents Peter the keys of the kingdom. That's why he gave them the understanding to unlock the door. Just because you're part of the congregation of the Lord, those whom he's elected from all the generations, you still don't understand his identity, you don't understand his truth, you don't understand his meekness, you don't understand his personage. Because, Father, if he could hide it from us on earth, then likewise I guarantee he could hide it for those that dwell in the Lord's holy habitation. And it's only the binder that's going to unfold the truth about Christ. He holds the keys. All others were thieves and robbers. You think some of those people the Lord has preserved and taken with him to his holy habitation, you think some of them were thieves and robbers? Of course they were. He said, all who have ever come before me were thieves and robbers. For who in heaven can be compared unto the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened unto the Lord? God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about him. These are talking about the saints that have returned with him that the Lord has taken to his holy habitation. Let me refer you quickly to Psalms 22, verses 30 and 31. A seed shall serve, and it shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. Not everybody, but one elected individual from each generation is made a part of the Lord's holy habitation team. And this is why Jude says he's going to return with 10,000 of saints. A seed shall serve him. It shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. They shall come and shall declare his righteousness unto a people that shall be born that he hath done this. They're going to come back home and they're going to declare Christ's righteousness. How are they going to declare Christ's righteousness? Because Peter was given the key. He unfolds the faithfulness of the Lord. And therefore they go back to their people and their generation and they assist in the gospel declaration. In closing, we now understand the progress and the procession of the truth. The Lord is seeking to build his permanent house. Death comes to all strangers, unauthorized spiritual teachers who violate the floating precepts of the temporary tabernacle, unless they join antitypical Peter when he erects the Hellgate Invincible Church. It is not a pitched Levitical tent, but a house in honor to Christ, so that he may enter into his rest. That's right, the Lord has a day of rest that he's looking forward to. Did you realize that? Turn with me to Psalms 95, verse 10 and 11. 40 years long was I grieved with this generation. And I said, it is a people that do err in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Imagine that. Israel came out of Egypt. The Lord personally communed with them, yet they didn't know his way. Why didn't they know his ways? Because they didn't have the key. Verse 11, unto whom I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest. The day is going to come, the Lord says, that he was going to have a rest. And some of the people that rebelled against him, he swore that he would not allow them to enter into his kingdom rest. Hebrews speaks to this. And now we could see a different dimension to what Paul proclaimed and understand it more fully today in the light of this new gospel. Verse 8 of Hebrews 4. For if Jesus had given them rest, then would he not afterwards have spoken of another day? You didn't get rest from Jesus, Paul is saying. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Verse 11, let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. This is the day of rest. This is the day when the Lord ceases from wandering from tabernacle to tabernacle. It's the day when he gains victory over the gates of hell. It's the day when his people can abide peaceably. Yesterday, if you abode in the tabernacle, you did so under the Lord's movable standards. Back then, sins such as whoremongering, fornication, debate, whisperings, adultery, malignity, homosexuality, lesbianism, flesh-eating, office-seeking, dress deformers, et al., had to pass through the judgment of the dead. Today, your shelter is under the shadow of the immovable standard, the Almighty. But take caution. Membership in this house of David demands adherence to his bond of testimony. Christ will cease his transitory abidance and finally find rest with his disciples. His rest is in earth's bindery, the bond of testimony. And with that, I bring the study to a close.